So my name's Scott Hawkins. I'm the Underwriting Manager for Munich Re for Australia and New Zealand, and I've been asked to chair this session today, which I think will be an interesting session on quantifying risk. So this morning you heard a bit about actual perils that we're exposed to and maybe some of the developments in those areas, what might happen with climate change and the changing world. Now we're going to talk about how do we quantify some of those risks that we know. We've got an excellent group of speakers today. First of all, we'll be led off by Ben Miliaskis. So Ben is the Head of Analytics at Aon Benfield in Australia and New Zealand. Ben's got a long background starting from the scientific, where Ben's a geographist by training, and Ben's had more years than he'd probably like to remember in building, using, telling people what's right, wrong about cat models. So I'd like to welcome Ben to the stage.
Thanks, Scott. I think this morning's session was a fantastic prelude to this next session that we're going to go through. My slides, the slide that I can see here, thankfully you can see it now as well. The slide deck that I've put together really looks at a series of the questions that we commonly receive when we're talking to executives and boards about catastrophe modelling. We've done close to 20 presentations now to various different organisations, largely on the back of a lot of the changes to APRA's requirements. This really is a bit of a mix of some of the common themes that we get. We'll start off with just some basics about catastrophe modelling and then lead into a little bit more about some of the things to think about when communicating catastrophe modelling results and what we actually get out of the models. I'll try and bring it back to this morning's presentations as much as we can, because I think there's some really interesting dynamics going on between the linking of science and what we need to do when communicating to executives and boards about what happens with modelling results. First of all, and this might seem a little bit axiomatic, but insurance companies deal with a lot of models. We've got models in various different aspects of the business, not just in underwriting and pricing, but also through claims, through sales and distribution, et cetera. What's unique about catastrophe models when we compare those applications to all the other models that we use is that all of the other models are largely based on experience. We have enough information that we've collected through our business, through the underwriting, et cetera, that we can use those to forecast what we may expect in the future. When we look at catastrophe modelling, however, this is very much based on an elemental understanding of the components that go into what we're trying to model. And that comes in the form of the science, in the engineering, so on and so forth. For that reason, we use a mix of different people to build these models as well. Quite often, it takes us out of our comfort zone. We go into a different gene pool to be talking to scientists, to be talking to engineers. And this really is, I think, a bit of a challenge, because quite often it's the actuary or the quantitative person inside the insurance company who needs to take into consideration the science that's underway, the lessons that are being drawn from other disciplines, and explain that to executives, to boards, so on and so forth. And quite often, that can create a bit of a disconnect. We saw a lot of the discussion this morning was around some of the great detail in the scientific work that's being undertaken. But whether or not someone at executive level, at a board level, is interested in understanding that detail and the implications of that detail for decision-making, I would question. Many a time when we talked about liquefaction before 2010, people's eyes glazed over. They weren't interested in these sorts of risks. But Christchurch showed us these are the sorts of details that we can't ignore, or we ignore at our peril. A little bit of a 101 slide here on the steps of catastrophe modelling. I've tried to go away from the old hazard vulnerability engine type model, but quite an important one to talk through very quickly. A few steps I'll draw your attention to. The first one really is step number one, and this is where we're G-coding risks. There was an awful lot of talk this morning about the hazards that we're looking at and the uncertainty around the hazards. There's very little discussion so far about vulnerability, either locating where our risks are or how those risks will respond when an event occurs. And if you think about some of the error margins that Mark was talking about, 30% increases in, say, acceleration, the implication of those changes on the way a property will respond when an event occurs is quite important. And so this is where these uncertainties and error margins get blown out quite rapidly, because we're talking about uncertainty upon uncertainty. I've got a diagram I'll show you a little while on that. The other aspect of this I'd bring your attention to is really building a catastrophe model is quite simple. In its most basic format, most models follow a similar sort of pattern. And if you can get your head around how we build, say, an RDS, say an earthquake in Sydney, we get what we'd call a footprint of what we think the isoseismals will look like. We then measure the impact of those forces on a building, estimate the amount of loss. Then we add up the losses, and that's how we get an event loss. What we then do in step number 8 is we just tweak it slightly. We might move where the epicenter is. We might change the depth. And this is how we build up a probabilistic catalogue. So we just do this tens of thousands of times. One of the challenges that comes in when we're doing this is that unless we're simulating enough events, that we won't truly capture all of the different types of loss we may suffer. And this becomes very important when we think of software architecture. We'll talk about this in a little while. But from a software architecture perspective, some of the models that we utilize use 10,000-year catalogs. And if you're running a 10,000-year catalog and you're modeling a 1 in 10,000-year earthquake like Mark was discussing, you're only going to get one of those events in each city across Australia when you're modeling it. And so the location of that event becomes quite dependent upon the modeler's choice, where they want to locate it, as opposed to the fact that there could be a lot of ambiguity around where that event is located. And this is one of the deficiencies that we see in some of the applications that we're using. Steps 10 and 11, I think, are more and more becoming of import to us when we're communicating modelling results. And I think quite often they're forgotten about. We think about the science of how we build CAT models, but not necessarily, firstly, in step 10, how we communicate the results. I've just put down a couple of points that I'd strongly people to think about when we're going through this task. And, what's been modelled? When you open up a box and take out your catastrophe model, not all models capture the same elements of the perils that have been discussed. Does it have demand surge? Does it have liquefaction? This is a pretty basic question that we need to understand what we've tried to model. How rigorous was the analysis? This is another point that I think quite often gets glossed over. It's very easy to get a result out of a catastrophe model. They're not that hard to load up and generate numbers from. But how trustworthy that result is based on the rigour that's gone into the work that's been undertaken. Do the results make sense? Time and time again, we see applications released that when you look at them in the cold light of day, just don't make sense. And that should be an automatic check to first of all question whether or not the application is modelling the peril correctly. But then if it is, what lessons have you learned about what you intuitively thought of the risk versus what's coming out of the model? Step 11, interpreting the results. What's the business context? What's not included, we've quickly discussed. What are the impacts of the non-inclusions? What are the error margins? And do the results fit with alternate views? Quite often we've got different approaches to the same peril in Australia when we're trying to model it. Comparing those results again gives great insight into the strengths and weaknesses of the different approaches, and maybe taking multiple views is justifiable. So four quick things to note about catastrophe models, and this is very much around when you take a model out of its box. This is not building one, but when you load up an application built by a third party, then really there's two key areas that you can influence the results in. The first is the input data, and the second is what I've called result interpretation. When I say result interpretation, that includes loadings on results. There's been a little bit of discussion over the last couple of years about making sure all the switches are turned on, so on and so forth. Really, that has a very minor impact on the results that come out. It's all about the input data, making sure you've got that right, and what you do with the results when you've got them out the back. Number two, I say that when we receive a CAT model, it's a large database. What this point's about is not the fact that it's a database rather than a spreadsheet, but more the point that it's rather locked down. The catalogue of events that we receive has been pre-compiled by the vendor and released to us. Where this becomes important is, say, after a cyclone or after an earthquake or any other peril event that occurs, the chances of us actually getting that event correct are very, very low. When you think about all the permutations of what Mark was discussing before, then really it's highly unlikely that we will get the geophysical characteristics of any true live event correct. Therefore, what we're interested in is making sure there's no systemic errors skewing the results in one direction or another. Number three, cat models have to represent reinsurance contracts. There's another point I'll make a little bit later about claims, but they're very much interlinked, where not all applications and not all perils are being modelled correctly for the way that reinsurance contracts work. And we need to know the strengths and weaknesses of these and understand the differences. And the example I've put up here is the hours clause with cyclones, in so much as most catastrophe models run cyclones for an unlimited period. And so some of the events that we can capture in could be exceeding the hours clause. How material that is has to be tested. I'd suggest it probably isn't a huge impact, but it's a very easy example of some of the differences that we see, particularly if you start thinking about some of the weirder reinsurances and the weirder capital structures that we can find available in the market. Number four, modelled uncertainty, is generally variability and loss. This is an absolute nightmare of a point to try and explain. It's quite complex. But in essence, what happens is in a catastrophe model, when we get secondary uncertainty, this is simply putting variability around the result that can be produced by the application, as opposed to truly modelling what we do not know. True uncertainty is aspects that we haven't even fathomed yet that may be impacting us, whereas this is not what we get out of a catastrophe model. Out of a catastrophe model, we're simply putting a distribution to a loss, as opposed to truly trying to capture all of the uncertain aspects of what could occur during a catastrophe. This ties in very, very closely with some of the work that Mark was showing this morning. This is an example from the US, and I think it's a really good example of where uncertainty comes into catastrophe modelling. This is for the New Madrid seismic zone. There's a little map down at the bottom, lots of detail, not important. But what it shows is there's been a lot of recorded earthquakes here. This is a well-known area. Now, this is the USGS 2008 logic tree for this earthquake when they try and model it. What you see is all these different branches that go out, and all we're doing here is getting to the point of ground motion modelling. And so we go through fault models, location uncertainty, recurrence uncertainty, magnitude uncertainty, and at each of these branches, we've got multiple different choices to make. Now, one of the reasons why we see such large variations in the applications that we use is depending on the choices that you make at each one of these little junctions will change the result. How meaningful that is has to be tested. Model evaluation is effectively going to each of these little junctions and testing the different choices and seeing whether or not we've got comfort with the choices that have been made, whether or not we think alternative views should have been taken, or whether or not they don't make a difference. There's just a little diagram to illustrate where the uncertainty comes in. So features of a good catastrophe model. First of all, it needs to be representative of the hazard. We want the modeler's choices at those various different points of that logic tree to have the smallest impact possible and the hazard itself to be the driving force of the results. Speed of use. I've purposefully ignored computing power in this presentation, but computing power is increasing what we're capable of at a huge rate, as you'd probably imagine. This comes into play in most of the applications that we're seeing now, and I'm sure that we'll be talking a little bit later about some of the great developments that are taking place in catastrophe modelling in the industry that are making that easier. We do need to remember, though, that we're trying to empower boards to make decisions with numbers. And so we're working to business timelines that mean that these models have to be run in a pretty quick fashion to let us run multiple iterations, advise on different choices, etc. They have to be scalable. A good catastrophe model should be able to produce moderately similar results depending on the resolution of data that's being provided. Obviously, you want it more robust, the finer data. But if you're modelling the entire country at street address, you should be producing the same results as if you run it at crest design or at state. The model should be able to handle different types of data. And the last point, this is more around the reinsurance space, where you want the models to be moderately comparable. One of the games that we like to play is comparing a risk across multiple different regions. And even in Australia, you'd like to be able to compare your earthquake risk to your cyclone risk across different geographies. And so unless the models are moderately comparable in what they're producing, then it makes life a lot more complex and it adds a pretty big flavour to the interpretation of the results. So where does cat modelling become difficult? We're going to park what's not being modelled. I think that should be discussed in the next presentation. Firstly, uncertainty exists at every step of the way. I think we've really talked about that today. The data used for calibration is very limited. This is quite an important point. Mark and I were discussing outside during the break, the epicentral location for the Newcastle earthquake still has an error radius of around 10 kilometres, depending on how we interpret that. And so we're taking that as one of the key earthquake events to have a look at our earthquake models and see how they're performing. A 10-kilometre radius, so 20 kilometres in diameter in Newcastle, covers a huge area of populated land space. And so depending on where it is inside that that radius or that circle will definitely change the way you interpret, say, the vulnerability data. It was very nice looking at Rick's graphic before of the... apologies, I can't remember what they're called, but those great little pads that catch the hailstones. The knock-on effects for that, not just from a hazard perspective, understanding where the hailstones are hitting, but being able to put that data next to the car that got damaged or the house that got damaged will increase knowledge of vulnerability tremendously. And when we have these sorts of error margins, it's very hard to get a good handle on how our assets at risk respond when the catastrophe event occurs. The population and its assets keep changing. This is a very similar sort of point, in so much as a natural question that we get from most boards, from most executives, is what would happen if event X occurred today? Now, it's very, very hard to try and compare what a house today would respond like in the Adelaide earthquake. We know what those houses did, but it's very hard to look at how the changes in building code, et cetera, will impact. One of the points that I think is going to be very interesting in the future is renovations. We're very good at modelling brick houses and timber houses and metal houses, but not a house that started off timber that someone's done a brick extension to, or a brick house that someone's put a timber extension to. These buildings will respond differently to any data points that we currently have in our catalogue, and makes it very hard to try and calibrate the models. Claims management is not formulaic. The more I hang out with claims people, and I hope there's no claims people in the room, but I really like them. They're quite interesting. We all sit here and use formulas to try and predict what a loss is going to be after an event. But depending on how the claims are being handled, whether or not the business decision is made to pay claims out fast versus to try and pay them out to what they could ultimately be for the most cost-beneficial perspective, will change what the result is. This is all being captured as model miss, demand surge, so on and so forth. But these are all impacts that we can't model correctly because it's based on human decision-making along the process. Communication and modelling has often been oversimplified. I believe, and I think a large part of this we'll get to shortly, is that the way that in Australia the modelling fraternity has developed has come out of reinsurance, particularly out of the broking space, etc., and some of the messages get lost to every part of that food chain. It's the old Chinese whisper story. And so quite a lot of the complexity that needs to come into the use of modelling results and the decision-making around that use has been oversimplified through history, that we need to spend a little bit more time thinking about and trying to communicate to make sure some of these uncertainties are understood. So very quickly, we're very tight on time, 5 misconceptions that I'd like to clarify. I've just talked to this point very briefly. The CAP models weren't developed for reinsurance. The applications actually grew up in the US in the 80s, based around underwriting support for hurricane risk originally. And what we've done is we've actually taken the opposite view in this part of the world largely and brought catastrophe models in as a reinsurance tool to look at our capital needs, as opposed to look at CAP modelling from an underwriting perspective. Why is this important? Firstly, I'd suggest that the impetus for change in aspects such as data, in aspects such as the use of results, has quite often come from a weird perspective. In so much as when we talk to clients about improving data, quite often the correlation to reinsurance or to capital assessment is the only aspect that's looked at, as opposed to trying to get the data right for underwriting and pricing in the first place. The other point that I'd just bring out here is that consistency or otherwise creates opportunities. And understanding how your capital providers are looking at your risk which is using the catastrophe models, can help you either identify where you'd like to follow the fortunes and have seamless logic between how they're viewing your capital requirement and how you're underwriting, or where you'd like to identify opportunities. Because if you're getting capital cheap because a model is saying that the capital is coming is under risk in comparison to what you think you can charge in terms of premium, creates growth opportunities as well. You may be better off writing risky business in a certain area if you can get the capital for that business cheap. Number two, not every cap model adds value. Model evaluation has been discussed in various different forums over the last few years. A lot of this is based around evaluation. The first question that we need to ask is whether or not a model is fit for purpose. Why is it important? I love this Warren Buffett saying, beware of geeks bearing formulas. It's really easy for someone to stand up and talk about a really complex model that sounds very impressive. Whether or not it's fit for purpose, whether or not it's overly complex or giving a false sense of understanding is something that needs to be discussed. The other aspect is, don't believe that all modelers build models correctly. That's not always the case. They need to be assessed, they need to be checked to make sure that they are a valid view of risk. Number three, model miss will never be defeated. We want to minimise model miss as much as possible. We're going back to the human elements of the event process. Model miss will always be in existence. Number two, the complexities of the perils will always mean that model miss will be there. Thirdly, we looked at, I discussed previously, that the interaction of the assets at risk with the models will change depending on how our risk landscape is changing. So we need to recognise that this will be different. This really is the nub of owning a view of risk. And it talks to the point around the decision making at the end of modelling is not finished when you get results out. That's when the decision making actually starts to try and look at what those results mean. Fourth, the 1 in 200 year loss is not an event. Time and time again, we sit in front of executives and boards. They say, well, okay, my 1 in 200 year loss is $57. What is that? Is that an earthquake in Sydney? Is it a cyclone in Brisbane? We say, it can be all of the above. When we look at an EP curve, we're talking about a dollar loss with a probability. That dollar loss could be generated by a big event in a sparsely populated area. It could be generated by a really small event in a heavily populated area. And it goes back to the question that Will clarified before around the return periods that Mark was talking to. What we look at on an EP curve is the probability of an economic loss as opposed to each individual city's recurrence interval of an earthquake. Where that earthquake occurs in the city will also vary the size of the loss, which leads on to my final point, that whole of portfolio modelling focuses on probability, not on loss. And this is where, when we look at the 1 in 1,000 year earthquakes coming back to roughly 1 in 100 year return period of economic loss, this is probably the most confusing concept for most boards and for an awful lot of executives. It takes a fair bit of time to discuss, but it really is a topic that I think is crucial when we start helping people interpret what's coming out of a catastrophe model. So in conclusion, building a catastrophe model is moderately formulaic, but the devil's in the detail. Getting it right is not easy. Producing answers is moderately easy, but making them trustworthy is not. Applying results of a cap model is expedient, but making them applicable for decision making takes consideration. Very easy to take the numbers out, but we need to think about them afterwards. And finally, if you can't explain it simply, you don't understand it well enough. Time and time again, we see people take modelling results, do a whole lot of convoluted changes to them, and actually lose the wood from the trees. The beauty is not in the complexity that you're applying to the results at the end. It's actually in what the macro level results are saying and how they're being applied in the business for decision-making purposes. With that, I will bid you adieu. Thanks very much.